Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're crushing morning miles or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.
This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
The last thing they saw was someone they trusted. You're tuned in to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, featuring retired FBI special agent and chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program, Robin Dreeke.
Trial of Richard Allen, it is underway right now in Delphi, Indiana. And it's a case that obviously has captivated us for quite some time. Is Richard Allen guilty of killing those two girls on that bridge, Abby Williams and Libby German, back in February of 2017? It's a case that, from what we're seeing now in the courtroom, relying thus far heavily on eyewitness testimony. We all know eyewitness testimony. Yeah, it can be good. It can be bad. It can be all over the board. And that's what we've seen thus far. Joining me to discuss, Robin Dreeke, retired FBI special agent, chief of the Counterintelligence Behavioral Analysis Program. Yeah, let's talk about this. Let's start with eyewitness testimony before we even get into what we've heard at the trial itself. Let's talk about its reliability and how that is gauged from person to person.
Yeah, our eyewitness testimony is always subject to context of the individual receiving the information, time from the time it was observed to the time it was recorded and reiterated on someone else. Influences that come to us between the time of viewing the information or the event, as well as the time of recounting it to someone else, the input that was happening there. Because that's what we're seeing in the court is I'm seeing potential for a lot of false memories being planted here by someone making a suggestion, it could be this or it could be this, to someone that was an eyewitness. That really influences what we remember. And that's why one of the great tenets of doing investigations is a simple one. Go where the evidence brings you. And evidence is generally very tangible, tactile types of things. And eyewitness testimony generally is not that tangible, tactile kind of evidence you're looking for. And so it can be extremely subjective in a lot of different ways, from not just how they're recounting it, the individual that saw it, the age, the time span, all these things make it extremely subjective, which makes it a very challenging case for prosecution to rely on that alone.
Let me ask you this, because the jury is hearing a lot of testimony from different eyewitnesses in this case so far. Some of the eyewitness testimony seeming to be pretty accurate, actually, and backed up and proven with surveillance footage. That would be the testimony thus far of a woman who was out hiking on the bridge, used it quite regularly for that. Noticed Richard Allen's car when she entered the trail when she came back. His car was gone. And that's a key piece of this whole case thus far from Betsy Blair. That's the name of the woman who has given this testimony. Because if that's true, and her timeline lines up of the time she says she left the parking lot and got in her car and Richard Allen's car was gone, of him not being there. And that same time point is when the state is saying he was in the woods killing those kids. It actually shows that he would have already gone for his walk and left and had been on with his day. If in fact he, you know, went to his car and left just as he kind of said he did. That's some interesting testimony. She also claims that she did see him out there as well and actually had more of an accurate physical description. You have two people who were 16 at the time, two girls who were out there now in their 20s testifying to this. And both of them claiming they saw a bridge guy, quote unquote, very dramatically different descriptions of the guy, like almost like it could be a completely different person. I almost kind of wonder if it was. So yet you have consistent and very inconsistent over here. One with timestamps and receipts to go with it. The other one, just these two girls recollecting what they saw when they were 16, and now that was 2017. So, you know, they're in their 20s now. Let's talk about the accuracy of that and how a jury is going to perceive that, where one seems to be pretty on par and the other one's like all over the board.
Yeah, it's not beyond reasonable doubt, is it?
It certainly kind of creates some doubt. I mean, in terms of like the information that's coming in, it's just the reliability of the information is what's at question. And I wonder if they're going to look at the two girls, the younger girls' testimony, and go, that's not reliable and it's eyewitness. Why is this one reliable over here? Even though there's a lot more that backs up the other one. If it's just kind of be throw the baby out with the bathwater, all eyewitness testimony is bunk, because with these two girls over here, it was really very scratchy.
So with this case, this is, man, I can't even believe I'm kind of saying this, because normally I'm always saying where there's smoke, there tends to be fire. Mm-hmm. And definitely Richard Allen was in the area.
Yeah.
I think that's irrefutable. You know, he was seen, he was observed, he's in the area. So that's smoke. But we're trying to draw that smoke to the fire of the death.
Yeah.
And normally when you're seeing eyewitness accounts and testimony and things like this, whether they're consistent, inconsistent, all these things, now what we want to do is we want to back it up with tangible physical evidence of these things, which is really lacking here. And that's what, so to me, it doesn't matter. Well, it matters, you know, the credibility, lack of credibility, accuracy, inaccuracy. All right. So he was there. Mm-hmm. So that has smoke. And so now we need to back the smoke up with tangible evidence of fire, linking him to the actual deaths of two girls. Mm-hmm. I still think I just still do not. And I've been trying to follow this as closely as possible, looking for something the prosecution has that they have in the investigation that will physically link him to the actual site where the girls died. Mm-hmm. The lack of DNA evidence, that is what's really striking to me here on two evidence, and I'm probably jumping ahead on you on this one.
No, you're fine.
But here's why that is bothersome to me. It's either indicating, it could be indicating multiple things. One, incompetence of the investigators, which we have a lot of data points for potential incompetence of the investigators, yes. So we can't throw that out. So that's a possibility. The other possibility is he wasn't there and didn't do it, mm-hmm. which is innocence. And another possibility, which is also to me extremely remote, and I'll tell you why in a second, is that he was there, he did do it, and he was so good at covering his tracks and his DNA footprint that he's able to wipe it clean. Mm-hmm. But when you look at his courtroom behavior of and all the reports of extreme mental duress, mental illness, and all his courtroom behavior of pacifying behaviors and all these things and the trauma, you know. Does that strike you as a type of individual to have the cognizant ability to pull off high crimes and misdemeanors of murder and have the wherewithal to cover his tracks to get away with it in this way?
Yeah.
So when you look at, you know, again, when you're using conjecture, you're always going to miss a data point in there. But from the optic I have, the data points are leaning towards, I just can't still make that connection besides the fact of, they have not demonstrated a known link between him and the girls. Mm-hmm. Random killings of two females by one male being totally random. Now, they happen. But again, when you're looking at law percentages, there's very, very, very low. There wasn't a stalking. Yeah. There wasn't it's not fitting a pattern of what you'd expect to see for this type of murder.
Yeah, we are certainly not seeing, at least as of now, a digital footprint or anything, which you think probably would have been introduced by this point of some sort of evidence of, like, on his phone, he was stalking the girls or whatever, on the device. Mm-hmm. Nothing. There's nothing. It's just because he seems to be just living his normal life. And then suddenly one day, according to the, you know, the prosecution, just snaps and decides to kill these two girls. Completely bizarre.
And I apologize, Tony.
Yeah.
And no other run-in with the law,
none.
Correct?
Yeah. Yeah.
See, it's such
It doesn't make any sense.
Massive spike.
Yeah. I mean, it is, it's a huge spike in behavior. I will say this, you know, we're talking about eyewitness testimony, and we've heard, you know, many people in the courtroom. I know many people who are there. Bob Mata, defense attorney, host of the podcast Defense Diaries, he's on the ground with us and he's giving us daily updates. But I'm checking other folks too, other people that we know and they're reporting, people I trust, people that have been contributors in other stories here. And it's interesting because the observation on Richard Allen in that courtroom, very different from person to person. Again, yeah. These are people I trust. These are good reporters. I talked with Bob Mata last night, and I asked him about that because I heard from some others that he's sitting there acting very, verklempt, like when the photos were being shown, swaying back and forth, this and that. Mm-hmm. That's what some of the reporting said. We don't have a camera, so we don't really know. And I asked Bob, he's like, I haven't seen any of that. He's like, I don't know what they're talking about. He's like, number one, it's hard to see him face forward the way it's all set up. But number two, he's like, and I'm not watching him all the time, but I'm seeing him interact with his attorneys. He's asking questions. He seems to be really with it, according to Bob. He's like, if we didn't know these other things about him, I don't think we'd even be questioning his competency in the courtroom right now. It's just interesting as we view all of it through each of our lenses, which is understandable because we've heard stories of him. We've seen him in court looking pretty like out of it. But apparently this time, not so much. But if you're already expecting that, that's, you know, some confirmation bias right there.
Yeah. And you hit it right there. You know, if you have an optic and lens of something you've heard before, that's your brain as a human species, as a human being, we love to try to identify patterns.
Yeah.
And so that's why the same thing here with eyewitness accounts, they're going to try to identify a pattern that they can do. And also, remember, people want to be the person that is the savior, the one that cracked the case wide open, the one that, you know, solved the crime, because they want to be their part of doing justice. And so they might try again. These aren't conscious negative things people are doing. It's just a law of our human nature.
Yeah.
Is that we're going to see things that might not have been there that we want to make that happened, that we want to have been part of this, that we want to have seen the killer and did our part for due diligence and justice for the families. Still not adding up to me on this one, though.
Welcome to the podcast. If you'd like to listen to an ad-free version of this episode and all of our episodes, then search True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. That's our premium channel where all of our ad-free and advanced episodes live, all in one place. True Crime Today Premium Plus. Search it on Apple Podcasts and press subscribe. Even try it for 3 days free.
You're neck deep in a dark, twisted tale. And just as the tension peaks, bam. A commercial about some miracle diet pill breaks the spell. It's like finding a fly in your soup after the first bite. But here's the fix. True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. You get to enjoy your crime stories without the junk. Ad-free episodes, extended interviews that go beyond the surface, and early access to all the gruesome details. It's like swapping out a can of cheap beer for a glass of fine whiskey. So search for True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe and keep the darkness flowing uninterrupted.